Welcome, Mike Daisy, to Cat Radio Cafe. It's really a treat to see you. I've been impressed with what you've been doing for a while. I can hardly believe that such exuberance and profundity exists in the same stage in the person of one guy. You just do a great job in The Last Cargo Cult and have before. Actually, the thing I saw was Why Theaters Fail. Theater failed in America. And let's just review a little bit about what you said about how the theater failed in America. Can you do it in an encapsulated, like a little vitamin-sized pill?
I suppose. The core of How Theater Failed America, the monologue, is sort of an exegesis and argument about the failure of American theater to embrace local theater, that the theater culture instead embraces a hub-and-spoke system that uses New York City as the central clearinghouse and then ships actors out to locations around the country, parts of what they call the regional theater system, which is the arena that traditionally I had been working in for a number of years, and those regional houses have been founded with the ideals of reinvigorating live performance in those communities, for those communities, and they had betrayed their ideals in favor of real estate and safety.
Well, that was the magical part of your lecture there, that the real estate really had replaced the theatrical part. How satisfied you were with your group of friends in your postgraduate moments, eating ramen and sleeping on a table and getting up to do theater every day, even though your resources were so limited. That was the heart of it.
Yeah, it's a personal, the personal story threads through my life in the American theater, the career that I've had, and then uses that to try to draw the audience into reflecting on their connection to the theater and looking at the gap that exists to say to people, if you remember what it was that drew you here, look at where you are now, and what is that gap? What's the distance between you, the way you thought things were going to be and the way they've turned out, and how can we even start to dream about bridging that gap?
Well, I'm curious to know how you have arrived at storytelling as a way of embracing your own social conscience and being able to share it and propel the audience to pay attention to what you see are the ills of our country and our world. Why storytelling, and really what were the little, the big steps to shaking off a script? Yours is unscripted, although obviously
correct,
the story is quite written. I don't know what the degree of unscriptedness is, and I hope you'll tell a little bit. But why that medium, which seems to be catching on in some peculiar way?
Well, first, the degree of unscriptedness is total. Yeah. I work from an outline that's on the stage with me. The pages I turn are the pages of the outline, and the performance you hear is created in the air in that moment as it is being performed.
Wow, so it's extreme variety from night to night.
Well, no, because when one tells a story again and again, you figure out what path you want to use, and it wears that path into place, and then the story comes up the same way storytelling works in the rest of the world. Storytelling is the act of narrative. It's hardwired into the human consciousness, much deeper than acting is, actually. It's why everyone can tell a story, you know. You don't want everybody to get on stage, but everyone actually can tell a story with great dramatic lift and build, and it's because storytelling, that act, is inherently different than acting. It's actually deeper in some ways. It connects very deeply to our spirit. And so as a consequence, using it as a form, what I love about it is it dissolves as many boundaries as possible between myself on the stage and the audience, and create a theatrical experience that happens in the room at that moment, that one night. It will only happen for these people in this way. And I think that finally makes it worthwhile to go to the theater.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if things are not going to be different, if it's not going to be for this moment, why don't we stay home? Why don't we watch Law and Order? We could just stay at home. It needs to be special, you know? And so finding this form and working at it has been sort of in the pursuit of dissolving those boundaries and making the event that happens in the room a ritual and an experience that's unduplicatable. And that's what's drawn me largely to the form.
What did you drop off? What did you leave behind as you began to take on the story? Had you been acting in parts, or had you been improvising?
I had a long history of being. I'd done a lot of acting in the traditional theater, and sort of conventional acting in plays, and I enjoy seeing conventional theater, good conventional theater, you know, and. So I don't love that, and I don't, and a tremendous amount of writing. And I think that the collision point for me, the reason the monologues, reason I found that form, I was a young man in Seattle working in the garage theater scene of Seattle, and it was really the connection of wanting something that embraced writing, that allowed me to create, that also allowed it to be free and open on the stage, that embrace the spontaneity of the page. It was a live event. And I think it also spoke to something. I grew up in far northern Maine, and there's a strong tradition of storytelling there in the region and in my family. And then on top of that, I was really into speech and debate in high school. I was really into it. And I did this event all the time called Foreign Extemporaneous Speaking, which is about... you get given a question about American foreign policy, and you have 20 minutes to do research in the library, and then you have to create a speech with no notes that you can deliver extemporaneously that summates a position on this foreign policy question. And you have to be able to remember, like, you have to be able to reference articles you've just read and be able to say what the bibliographic is. And so I was really into this. And I thought it was like sort of a hobby when I left high school, of course. How will that be useful? But I actually think when I found the form in the 90s, and like 97, I did the first monologue. I think that, I think it was like the collision point of all those, passions.
Did you do those foreign policy things in accents? That's just a,
No.
You had to do it also in the foreign accent of the foreign country that you were referencing. Well,
they don't let you have much theater in the, in the extemporaneous debate. And perhaps, you know, one has to create a monologue if one wants the humor and the pathos and the foreign policy and the intellectual, and you want it all to collide,
then you,
know,
do that.
You have to do what I'm doing now,
right,
I guess.
Right. Well, you do that. And in fact, I mean, so much of this is somebody referred to what you do as journalism as gonzo journalism, and I guess there's some, although not much drinking or drugging at all mentioned in this. A little chocolate, a little pemmican, maybe.
Interesting. Like while I was in the island, and in fact, there used to be a scene in the current show. There used to be a whole scene where I would talk about drinking kava and ecstatic visions, and there was actually a very long. It wasn't very long, but it was a scene all about the ecstatic visions, and it's an interesting thing how when you're shaping a story, you have to do what is in service to the story and nothing else. And so things that seem like they would obviously be in the show, but I mean, how could X not be in the show? It's amazing how much gets left on the floor. Yeah. So actually, in this case, this story that I tell every night at the Public would have tremendously strange drug experiences, except they do not actually further the argument of this particular show.
Let's talk about the argument of this particular show.
Sure.
The gonzo journalism involves actually going to an island in the South Pacific, and in a very scary way, taking very, very scary method of little tiny planes, island hopping till you got to the island, and then traipsing from one end of the island to the other, all quite part of not the usual comedian's tale about you know, what the conditions were like in an airplane. These are really death-defying. And getting to the island, which you had selected. You knew about the John Frum celebration, the festivity of John Frum on this island. And you'd read about it? Where was it? In the theater news?
No, it's really interesting. It was actually the degenerative moment that led to this monologue existing. The monologues all grow in different ways, since they're not written in any way.
Yeah.
They grow very organically, often over long periods of time. And I've been thinking about cargo cults for many years, 3 or 4 or 5 years I've been reading about them.
Can you tell a little bit about what a cargo cult is?
A cargo cult is an anthropological phenomenon that it refers to a wide variety of phenomena. The one that most people are talking about is the fact that during World War II, the Americans didn't know where the war in the Pacific was going to go. And so they built bases, in some cases, on very remote islands in the South Pacific. Sometimes they had not had sustained contact with the outside world in any way. And so you have people who have a culture that's been in place 2,000-3,000 years without much real disruption. And then overnight, all these white people show up. And they build Quonset huts, and they build runways, and they have chocolate and cigarettes and refrigerators and radios and all of this incredible stuff that they've never experienced. And then the thing that makes it magical is that they leave. Because World War II wraps up on schedule.
Right.
The Americans then leave. They don't need the bases, and they take all their amazing things with them. And all over the South Pacific, independent of one another, religions sprang up that worshipped America, mm-hmm. or more accurately, they worshipped the power of America. Mm-hmm. They worshipped the objects of America, the same religion we practice today.
Here.
Yes.
In America.
In the first world. The
yes.
show, the show connects America to these events, but really it's a show about the third world and the first world. And ultimately, by the end, really how it is actually one world, but how wildly different those places are. So I would posit that religion of objects, of power, is the religion of the first world, but really it's the religion of everywhere. The third world's
now
difference.
It is, isn't
well,
it?
The, yeah, well, and the third world's difference
with
is that
the
they
bringing,
don't have the
right.
objects that they
with
want.
With the bringing of objects, and of course your thesis here about money is very, very profound. By the way, Henry Paulson was invited to that Kennedy Center Award for Artists. How about that?
How about
he
that?
He was a guest. And went that out, maybe, you know, put an extra hex on that event. But you talk a lot about what money is and also what it isn't, what
mm-hmm.
how meaningless it is, and how the people of this Pacific island had really disregarded money for the longest time. And,
yeah.
and I expect still, to some degree, still do.
Oh, yeah.
But the objects have much more meaning than the money, because money is
right.
nothing.
Yeah, money is not widely adopted on this particular island of Tana. There, in fact, is a kind of economic war going on day by day, village by village, about whether money, whether it bills, in their case, the Vanuatu Vatu, whether it actually has value at all.
Right.
You know, some people want the Vatu, some people don't, and it depends. You know, system, you can see how much money relies on faith. On trust, when you're in an environment where the system is not fully implemented. Like, if you give me a Vatu, it's worthless unless I can find someone who wants to take that Vatu from me in exchange for goods and services.
Right.
In a place where it's half implemented, you can actually see the frayed ends. Here, we're sitting on Wall Street right
uh-huh.
now. Here, in the heart of it, you can't even see,
anymore, see
anymore the perspective. It seems more real than the things that are physically real here. It
used to be under the sidewalk over there at the Federal Reserve.
Right.
But I think it's
right.
not.
But now, of course, we aren't on the gold standard.
Right. That's right.
So there's no need for us to have filthy physical objects around when we can make it entirely abstract.
And conceptual, yes. So we are in a big morass here with this conceptual value of this thing that basically doesn't exist for anybody, but we all want it.
Yes.
You make this very dramatic. I don't know how much you want to, how much the surprise element of The Last Cargo Cult depends on knowing about the money.
Mm. Oh, well, we can talk about
okay,
that.
Okay, talk a little bit about this. And at what point in the generation of the story, The Last Cargo Cult, did your theatrical idea come to give out money in different increments to everybody who walked into the show? I think everybody gets it, right?
Yes.
Everybody gets a little
yes.
something.
Yes, the way it works is that the monologue is in the center and forms this sort of overarching argument about what money actually is. But before the show, as people enter the house, they are each given a bill. There are people standing at the doors who are not ushers and they don't hand out programs. Their job is just to have a big stack of money. And everyone who comes in is given a bill. And some people get $1 bills and fives and tens and twenties and fifties and $100 bills randomly assorted. And people get these bills and they sit in the audience. It's a tremendously charged thing because people, I was surprised at how disruptive it is alone just to give people money. Is actually very disruptive. They sit and they have the experience of watching the show, and early in the show, about a third of the way through, I start talking about the money they are holding, and I talk about, you know, consider the dollar. You're holding some right now. When we talk about how it is made of rag paper,
right.
And they are all identical, but you know what it's worth because the fundamental element of currency is that it's one of the few things in the world you know exactly what it's worth because it's printed on it. And then we start talking about how actually they're all constructed exactly the same way. So really, it's the arrangement of the ink. That is actually
that
what
is
the
value,
difference between
right.
these pieces of paper that you know so completely. And I use it to sort of deconstruct the faith. Based system and how much of our faith, how it is actually not real in the physical, epistemological world, but we believe it and that makes it real. That, so then people are set at ease. They're like, oh, that's why he gave us the money. And then there's a reveal near the end of the show that, in fact, the money they are holding does not belong to this theater or this institution, that it is my money. And it is, in fact, all of the money that I have made for this performance that I've been paid, I have now given to them. And they are holding my livelihood because, in fact, I am a working artist. So they actually have all of my money.
And they are faced then mm-hmm. with the moral dilemma.
Well, and I use it to sort of help illuminate the paradox of money, that on one hand it is abstract and it is actually meaningless. And so perhaps you should rip it up and burn it. And no wealth would be created or destroyed.
As they would do on the island of Tana.
Yes, and on the other hand, I need that money. I do, I need it. I won't be able to pay rent if I don't get that money back. And at the conclusion of the entire show, during the curtain call, while I'm talking, I talk to the audience, I thank them for coming, and then someone brings a bowl to the stage and puts it on the table, and I say, this bowl exists because if you would like to see that I am paid for my work today, you can put money in this bowl. You can put the money you were given, or you can put more money than you were given, or less money, or no money at all.
Yeah,
and then I leave, and the audience has a choice, and it can come to the stage and see that I'm paid, or it can leave with my money.
And does your nut vary each night?
You mean the amount that I handed out at the beginning?
Yes.
No, because I'm paid the same amount for this particular run, for instance?
No, I mean, does the audience return it? Does the audience return it in full? Do you get shortchanged some nights? Do you get more than you got paid on some nights? What's the variety?
It varies.
It does.
And, for instance, in New York, mm-hmm. we've been losing money.
You've been losing money?
Yes, people are taking my money.
Well, like I told you outside.
In many other major cities, though, we come out
generous.
Ahead. It has
rents are lower in other cities.
But it has a lot less to do with the nature of the people of New York and a lot more to do with the nature of the experience they're having. We've been in previews at the Public Theater, and that means a certain number of people are papered. Our experience so far, and we don't have complete data sets yet, but our experience is it's all about perceived value. People who paid more for their tickets tend to be more generous.
What's it to them at this point anyway? Mm-hmm. They've already paid so much. And as you pointed
that's
out,
part of it.
It's a long show, time is money, so mm-hmm. they've made an investment in the show.
Yeah, it's very interesting, like what people are willing to give, whether they value this thing that's happened. Also, it's fascinating to see something I talk about in the show, that diffraction between the abstract and the visceral. When they're in the room with me, I can feel their human connection. The audience coalesces, and they are hearing what I have to say. Then the lights go up, and a certain percentage of people have had that real experience, and it was real, then really choose to put the money in their wallet
and
walk away.
And the others.
And that gap.
Sneak out.
Is interesting.
Right.
Me.
Oh. And you watch them carefully. Will you ever talk about it? Will you ever talk?
No, I don't watch them.
Oh, you don't see who's sklunking out and it's just.
I mean, if I did, that would increase the level of shame. If I wanted to just make sure the money would come back, I'd put the bowls at the door and shame everyone into returning
it. Right.
They have to make an
effort.
No, actually,
they have to go right
on
stage
and return the money. Right. And if they don't, then they can keep my money.
Well, I got a dollar, like I told you outside. I did get $1, mm-hmm. and my friend got a 20. And I was immediate, of course, the value of that 20 was, she said she'd buy me a drink afterwards, because she was embarrassed that she'd gotten 20.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of the show, she had to return a 20, and I had to only return a 1, so it was nothing to me at that point. But nonetheless, this was so deeply thought-provoking that you tied this to a cult that had a religion based on artifacts. It was based on this illusion of America being something fantastically great and powerful.
Yes.
And then this piece of money that really, which we now question as having any value at all, because the world is shaken under our feet, really.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I mean, the even more grim reality in some ways is that that religion, I mean, that is true. They worship the objects of America because they have power. They do have power. That power exists. We use it to fly planes in the sky. We use it to make our way of life possible. We may use it to
further
establish and sustain the inequity that exists. I mean, we use it primarily to make sure the wall stays up so that those of us who have continue to have and those who do not continue to not. I mean, it's very important to us. So there is power. It's actually, it seems an entirely rational thing. I live in a country where most people are worshiping, you know, I think they're worshiping a 2,000-year-old carpenter who they cannibalize at rituals on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the idea of worshiping our objects because the power and they want the power in their hands seems very logical, you know? It's like there's an honesty to it that's very straightforward.
Well, as long as I would love to talk to you, and I would love to dedicate more time, I hope you do come back and talk on maybe for a, you know, whole hour here sometime soon. Your role really is larger now, frankly, than that of an actor or a writer, because you're in a kind of position of preacher, really, or moral mm-hmm. conscience. And how much change do you think you've affected doing, you know, working this land, working the land of the conscience on a theater audience, which is a lazy audience, I would think. Lazy in the sense that they're not out on the street with, you know, poles and,
you
know, collection pots. They're enjoying themselves. And mm-hmm. you do mention that we're in the business of fun.
Right.
The whole country's in the business of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your gauge of how seriously people are really beginning to take your words?
It's a really good question. You know, I try to do the same thing I do in the shows in that I try to make it personal. So I gauge a lot of the success for me on the feeling during and then after the shows of connection, and not just connection between me and the audience. That's my job to start. The connection I feel between audience members. Like when I overhear or sense or people tell me that they went off and they kept talking about the show, like the things stay with them outside the room. Theater has a terrible tendency to dissolve
right.
at the moment of its performance.
Right.
That's the beauty of it.
Right.
But it needs to be able to, in its dissolving, leave a mark, tattoo itself, you know, brand itself into people. Otherwise, nothing gets carried out of that room. And so, for me, I feel like things are succeeding when I get a sense of real connectivity. You know, when I hear stories, when I can feel people thinking back at me.
Yeah.
When I have done my lifting and then I feel them lifting up to reach back. That's where I kind of look for personal fulfillment. It's hard. It's hard to see sometimes. Why? Is there going to be any change? It feels almost impossible. And so I look for the personal.
Well, it's a new way of changing the world, but I want to say storytelling, changing the world. It's the way, isn't it? It's got to be it's certainly no guns involved.
It's true. It's true. It's not killing so many
people. It's an easy exchange of money. You lose nothing. Mike Daisy, you are really a phenomenon, and the show is called The Last Cargo Cult. It's playing at the Public Theater until not very long. You don't have all that much time to see it, and you swear it won't happen again. But
Well, I can't afford to keep it running.
All right. Well, we'll figure out something for you,
because
you deserve it, that's for sure, if that counts. Does it count to say you deserve anything? I don't know.
Well, it's our culture.
That's our
culture. Like money.
Yes.
I deserve it.
Okay.
Send me a check.
Here's some imaginary money. It's the same thing. Thank you, Mike Daisy. Come again, please.
Thank you so much.